The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to former Jerry Garcia and Grateful Dead manager Richard Lauren, whose autobiography, High Notes, a rock memoir, was just published. Stick around. All except for you, Bertha. Bertha, don't you come around here no more. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Daily Motion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you prefer to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media Interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience that, when stoned, can't tell Jerry Garcia from Cherry Garcia in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Thanks to my college buddy, Jim Doten, I have been to a Grateful Dead concert. It was sometime in the early 80s when the San Francisco Circus came to the University of South Florida Sun Dome in Tampa. As a longtime Deadhead, Big Jim was eager to share one of his favorite things with his straight arrow little buddy. And if you knew Jim, the mellowest of the mellow, you'd know it's hard to say no to him on just about anything. And I never pass up a chance to spend a day with one of the greatest friends I have ever had. Now, I'd like to tell you that being there changed my life, but it didn't. Still, the music was pleasant, the mood relaxed, and you didn't have to smoke anything that day to leave the arena with a buzz. Now, when I received Richard Lauren's new book, High Notes, a rock memoir, I took it seriously because I knew that a generation of guys just like Jim, and including our mutual friends from the University of Miami, including Dave the Rave and the Two Peets, would also be interested. After all, Lauren worked as Jerry Garcia's personal manager for many years and managed the Grateful Dead itself from 1974 to 1981. But while that was certainly the apex of Lauren's public career, his experiences on the way to Haight-Ashbury, documented with the help of co-author Stephen Abney, were equally the stuff of legend. The man started his career cooling Liberace in the summer heat, bailing out Jim Morrison of the Doors, and sneaking pot across the Canadian border for Spencer Dryden of the Jefferson Airplane. This guy has lived multiple lives, I think. Richard Lauren, welcome to Mr. Media.
All right. Pleasure to be here, Bob.
Glad you could join us. And I cannot tell a lie. The former rock critic in me loves a good behind-the-scenes rock and roll story. You know, it's always, aha, so that's what they were up to, you know. I mean, I assume that there's much, much more even than what's in the book.
Well, yeah, there's always stuff on the cutting room floor, right? Whether it's a movie or a book or, you know, you got to tighten it up. And, you know, that's why it's a lot of authors, like they have on their website, they have other stuff that's not included in the book. But I didn't have time to compile that. And I just wanted to get the book out and that's it for now anyway.
Very good.
Very
now,
good.
We're going to get to the Dead stuff in a few minutes. But I got to say, you're the first person I've spoken to who actually spent time with Liberace. I mean, Liberace, do you find yourself still shaking your head that even happened?
Absolutely. And I never expected Liberace to be who he was. You know, I thought it would be this fey guy, would never be able to really connect with him. But he shows up, you know, in his limousine, in his flowered print shirt, in his white linen suit, not in his hot pants, you know, like I thought maybe he'll show up in those in this hot summer day. And, you know, he was the kindest man, and he treated his audience really well. He put on one of the most amazing shows that I had ever seen. And I just didn't expect a three-hour spectacle where he did like 10 or 15 costume changes and always ready to please the audience. And he was like, see why they called him Mr. Showmanship, for sure. And he cut me a break. You know, I mean, he had some problems at the theater I was working with the intense heat. I got attacked to create some fans for him. In his contract rider, he required that we have a dinner available for him after his show, for he and his entourage. And, you know, I contacted a hotel, a restaurant in Baltimore to put on a dinner at like 1 o'clock in the morning. And they invited other people to have dinner. So it was like an event, and Liberace was there having dinner. And, you know, I had the chef create his perfect chicken Kiev dinner. And anyway, at the end of his run, he was really pleased with the job I had done, taking care of he and his entourage. And when his agent and manager came to town, he told them that they should maybe hire me as an agent. I never had any thoughts really about being an agent at that time, but it turned out that way.
Where did you think your career was going to go at that point?
Well, I guess before I became a 10th theater manager in Baltimore, I really wanted to get into the theater. I was really a student of theater in college. I was an English major, drama minor. I did some stage managing. I did some little direction. And so I was really enamored of theater. I wanted to start my own repertory theater company. However, the year before I was the manager at the theater, I went to Tulsa and tried to start a repertory theater there. But I found it, you know, not only was it, there was no money in it, and you'd have to raise money, be a whole fundraising thing. And I loved the collective experience of putting a show together, everybody working together on a common goal. And I thought that would, and I love drama, you know. So anyway, so when the idea of being an agent, I lived in New York, so the agent said, well, come on up to New York and we'll have an interview, you know. I'll be glad to talk to you and see if it might be something you'd want to do. So I went up, and, you know, it wasn't even an interview. They hired me right away. They said, the job is yours if you want it, and you can, we'll put you in charge of the college concert division from colleges from Maine to Florida. But ironically, when I accepted the job and I was given the sheet, the roster of talent that were represented by the agency, I found that they only had like Liberace and Victor Borger and Roger Williams and Anita Bryan and John Davidson. And you know, maybe the hippest artist was Chad Mitchell, you know? So I said, I don't know what I'm going to do here. And I realized that, you know, if I wanted to keep my job and get some commissions and sell some performers to schools, that I was going to have to go to Greenwich Village and start trolling for talent, which is what I ultimately did.
It's weird that you had to find your own talent. I mean, but I guess what you're saying is that the hip college kids at that point, they weren't looking for John Davidson and Anita Bryant, huh?
No, not at all. Well, they, you know, it was in that period. It was already like 1966, you know, so they had a little taste of the Beatles, they had a taste of the Stones. So, and I came to rock and roll a couple of years later than most people did. I mean, I was into the rock and roll of the 50s, and, you know, with Chuck Berry and Carl Perkins and, you know, all the great stars of the 50s. And they were what I grew up in as a teenager. And then I got into folk a little, you know, a little taste of Dylan, but, you know, I really wasn't really what they'd call experienced yet at the time, you know. Then the Beatles came to town. I was a junior in college, and that changed everything, really. I mean, they came in and played in 64 to in America, and they played a tour of the country, and, you know, went to the Delmonico Hotel where Bob Dylan turned him on to a joint for the first time. And, you know, their music changed from I Want to Hold Your Hand to Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds in a couple of years, you know. So they then all of a sudden rock and roll changed. It changed, and then a lot of the Grateful Dead, the Jefferson Airplane, and a lot of the groups from San Francisco embraced the songs that were coming out, the melodic music that the Beatles and then later the Stones, put out in this country.
Well, let's not get ahead though. So you
I
know you went to the Village. You started looking for bands. What did you find, and what was the response of the bands to you? You know, kind of checking them out.
Well, the first real client I got was Tim Buckley, who is Jeff Buckley's dad. For the younger folks who don't know who Tim Buckley is, he was kind of like the anti-artist. You know, he was his own worst enemy. He was a gentle soul with a 4-octave voice range, and he wrote and sang just beautifully. And I saw him at a club in the Night Owl, just popped in there one night, and I heard this kid sing, and I just fell in love with his music. His manager was there, and at the end of the evening, the manager said, you want to handle him? You can represent him if you want. I said, well, okay, that's good. I'll try. And I got him a couple of gigs, but in trying to score, in trying to get some colleges to be receptive to the artists I had, they kind of laughed at me. And this one student at the State University of New York in Long Island, he called me up one day and he says, Richard, he said, I want to give you an inside tip. He says, I just talked to Bill Graham, the manager of the Jefferson Airplane, and I got him. The Jefferson Airplane are going to come to town to break their new album. And he said, they're going to be performing at my school, but I understand they're going to play a couple of weeks at the Cafe Agogo on Bleecker Street. So, wow, that's all I needed to hear. I said, so I just shot down to Bleecker Street and went to the Cafe Agogo, met Bill Graham, who was hawking his posters. He was always the entrepreneur, Bill, so he and I got along fairly well, and I got to meet Marty Balin, who is very ingratiating and very sweet guy, and I took a liking to him right away, and he was actually the most talkative of the band members. They all looked like freaks to me. I'm this kid, I just come out of college, basically. I had fashionably long hair, and I wore jeans and a sports jacket. I never really knew what I was about. But then, when I first met the guys, it was like, wow, And then one thing led to another, and at the end of the run, I took Bill Graham up to meet my boss, who was a little older than Bill. He's like about 50 years old, kind of out of the rock and roll loop, but a really smart, good agent, and he was involved in personal appearances. He had just signed Rowan and Martin just before the Laughing Show, so he knew what he was doing, and he really impressed Bill. They got on like scotch and rocks, and so they agreed to have me represent the Jefferson Airplane, and shortly thereafter, it just catapulted into other groups.
Now, I know that you continue to be friends with Marty Balin, who lives here in the Tampa Bay area. But I don't want to sound unkind about this, but the Airplane has not held up to history as well as some other bands from that era. The music is not played as much. It's not, it's not the first band that we think of a lot. What would you want? But my question is this: what would you want young people today to know and to understand about the place that the Airplane had in the 60s and?
Well, basically, they were the group that's associated with the Summer of Love, really, at first. I mean, they were the first breakaway group in San Francisco. I mean, Grateful Dead followed the Jefferson Airplane. I mean, the Grateful Dead were like a very, I hate to use the word cult, but they were very underground. They were doing the acid tests, and the Jefferson Airplane broke out with Somebody to Love. And shortly thereafter, White Rabbit. So that made the San Francisco sound knowable and a commodity to the rest of the nation, really, because they, and then after them came Country Joe and the Fish and all the other groups that came out with the funny names in San Francisco, But they were really the first ones. And basically, Marty Balin really was the first guy to really make the San Francisco Sound happen. I mean, Ralph Gleason was the journalist for the San Francisco Chronicle that wrote about the Jefferson Airplane and told about, you know, what the kind of music they were playing and how good they were and so on. And Marty Balin was really the first mainstay. I mean, he became a businessman in order to have a vehicle for he and the band to play. He got a couple of businessmen together, and they bought the Matrix, which was a club in San Francisco where the Jefferson Airplane began to play. Actually, the Doors played there in 67, and all the groups in San Francisco played there. So I would say the Jefferson Airplane were the first exponents of rock and roll to the world, at least from Northern California. And I wasn't really that close to the L.A. scene until, of course, I got involved with the Doors and Jim Morrison. But I think Grace and Marty had two of the greatest voices in rock and roll. I mean, Grace, Marty's lives a little under the shadow of Grace Slick. I mean, Marty has, along with Jim Morrison and Roger Daltrey and maybe Steve Winwood, one of the greatest voices in rock and roll. And is a great songwriter. Mm-hmm. The thing about the Jefferson Airplane is I think they didn't stick around long enough. I mean, they kind of broke up in 1969. I had quit the business in 1969 for a short period of time, for a year, and just before Volunteers of America came out. So I got them in the heart. I wasn't associated with the Starship. But somehow or another, when I went to visit Marty in 1970, when I was getting back into the scene, I lived with him for a while. And, you know, he was having his outs with the other members of the band. You know, I think drugs were a big issue. Marty was not into cocaine. A lot of the other guys were into cocaine. And Marty wanted to rehearse and do songs. And those guys were just not into it at the time. So he became really, this, you know, no longer enamored with the scene, with his bandmates. And I think I remember, you know, Paul saying to me, "Richard, you know, what's it with Marty?" As I was living with him at the time, he said, "Well, I don't know. I don't know. It's up to you to talk to Marty. I don't really know what's going on with you guys. It's your problem." But I mean, from my vantage point, that's kind of how I saw it, Bob.
What was Grace Slick's appeal? Was it sexual? I mean, obviously she had a great voice, but you talk a little bit in the book about Grace.
Well, she was raw, spontaneous. You know, she was the real first proto-feminist before even feminism was in. She spoke her mind, and she defied the culture in which she grew up in. She was a rich kid, went to Finch College, learned how to set tables and how to look good so she could score kids at boys from Princeton. And she said, you know, "I don't want any part of this." And the readers of my book will see during a concert at it was a light show for Glenn McKay that Jefferson Airplane were invited to perform. And she was in her cups and under the influence. She just lambasted, you know, all those people that she grew to dislike.
If she was coming up today, and if you look at, I don't know how familiar you are with the current music scene, but who would she be today among the, you know?
I think she would be really unique. She's certainly not going to be, today rock and roll has become so corporatized that it's hard to really find a unique singer. I mean, you got some really beautiful singers, but they're commodified starlets, so to speak. You know, you don't get these pure, outspoken people in the music world today. I mean, you get great performers. You have your Gillian Welch. You have your Lucinda Williams. You have your, she's a little older now, and Bonnie Raitt and all them. But you have Lake Street Dive. But it's not the same. It's not the same. I mean, why? I just, the times are different.
All right. Well, the other thing, there's a lot of things to talk about, so I want to make sure we cover good ground here. But you're actually the second person. Now, Liberace, you were the first person I spoke to who had experienced Liberace, but you're the second person I've spoken with who spent time with Jim Morrison of the Doors, just to clear up. The first was a guy named George Greer, who was a longtime judge here in St. Petersburg, Clearwater, who attended St. Petersburg Junior College with Jim Morrison and had his own memories of him. But Yeah. I mean, what's the first thing that you tell people about, you know, when they find out your connection with Morrison? I'm sure people are quite fascinated with this. What do you tell them? What do you want them to know about Morrison?
Well, I think he was a beautiful soul. You know, he was a shaman, really. I think he was the first and foremost man to be totally possessed by his muse. You know, I mean, he danced on fire like nobody. You know, you take a lot of the great rock and roll performers, whether they be, you know, Led Zeppelin or, you know, Robert Plant, or you take Mick Jagger, for instance. Now, Mick, you know, he's fantastic. He's a great, you know, look at him on stage. He's one of a kind. But, you know, you look at James Brown, you know, and then you look at Mick Jagger, and you see where he got his moves from. With Jim, you don't know where the moves came from. They came from within. Because I watched, I don't know how many shows I attended, and I was always surprised. I mean, he had some stances that were similar, but he didn't know what he was going to do next. The band members didn't know what he was going to do next. And those guys were telepathically connected to Jim. I mean, they knew to follow every one of his moves, you know, like they create sounds behind his movements. I mean, they played to his choreography and to his poetry. And he'd move a certain way, and John would hit the snare drum, or Robbie would squeal on a note, or Ray would do just a sound on the organ. So it's not. First of all, they're absolutely unique. The Doors, they're like nothing else. I mean, Bill Graham had once said, "The Grateful Dead are not the best at what they do; they're the only ones that would do what they do." But Liberace, you know, falls into the same category. Jim Morrison falls into the same category. And I must say, Ray Slick falls into the same category. I did Janis and so on. But a lot of the people from that era were unique unto themselves.
Now, a lot of people who you know, are in rock and roll or pop music for that matter, they craft a persona that, you know, or they have help, or they've had help crafting a persona that helps them sell records, keeps them in the public eye. Morrison, you get the sense that he was just being Morrison. There wasn't a lot of deliberate stagecraft. He was just being who he thought he was.
Absolutely. And he was fueled by psychedelics and alcohol. I mean, he was one person straight and a completely different person, you know, under the influence, you know, and he was shy, he was vulnerable, he was kind, he was friendly, but he felt that, you know, he needed to release something within him that he needed to get out. And he took a lot of psychedelics, and, you know, the band members literally have to go to the hotel when Jim didn't show up either for the studio or for a performance and drag him out. And, you know, half the time he was just loaded. And then he went on stage and he would perform brilliantly, brilliantly. So, and I've seen both. I've seen him be completely straight before a show. In a matter of fact, he would lock himself into a dressing room in the dark and spend like 10 minutes there before the show, and then just walk out on stage and do a contained, beautiful Morrison show. And then, by the same token, I'd see the flip side too. You know, I'd see him like wild the night before, you know, after a show at a party, he'd be under a table barking like a dog because he got bored. You know, he would do all outlandish things. The next morning at 7 o'clock in the morning, he'd come to breakfast, all smiles, no hangover, you know. And I really loved him. I think that he was one of those shooting stars that, he was a shaman for his generation. He broke us through to the other side. You know, he's one of those rock musicians that helped rock the world. And he broke through the American psyche, you know, of bourgeois American psyche, and had him wake up. He was really, to me, I mean, you have Leonard Cohen, you have Bob Dylan, but, you know, and a little bit Ginsberg tried to, but the poet musician. I mean, he wasn't a musician, but he was the poet in a rock band. And they supported his poetry. And I think Jim almost quit several times, even in the first two or three years of his career, because he was tired of just being the idol to his fans. I mean, he did it for the first couple of years, and he got off on it. But then, you know, he just really wanted to be a poet. You know, he just wanted to sit down and write poetry. And, you know, music is a kind of magic that casts a spell of enchantment on us all, you know. And to be moved by the music is to experience, like, its power. And when you take that music and you fuse it to this incredible poetry, you know, or even lyrics, doesn't have to be poetry. I mean, it just becomes much, much stronger and powerful.
Do you think that with Morrison, it was everything was drug fueled, or do you think there was? I mean, today everybody's got some mental illness, right? I mean, would if he were playing today, would he be diagnosed with a mental illness that led to the drugs? Or would,
well, it depends how much money he was making. Ah. They wouldn't arrest somebody that's making enough money if he can stay contained. And basically, you know, being on the road with him, I had to be his babysitter. And within the band, Ray Manzarek was the caretaker of the Doors, really. I mean, he was the most common sense guy. He was the guy that I really connected with the Doors. I mean, I needed that sane ally within the band that was able to, you know, to make sure that Jim, you know, didn't go off the deep end too often. As you've read in my book, that, you know, I had a hard time doing that, and there were experiences that were it came out okay, and others where it didn't.
Of course, there was the time where you had to bail him out.
Yeah,
a little run in with the police. Gee, Jim Morrison and the police. Who would have guessed?
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, Jim Morrison with the police. I mean, that was a case in point of police brutality, basically. I mean, here we are talking about that as a subject now. But what happened was, very quickly, is that, you know, I was out having dinner with Ray Manzarek and our girlfriends, and we show up at the gig in New Haven. Jim came up on his own in the limousine, met a girl at a restaurant, invited her to the show. She went backstage, and he was talking to her in the dressing room. A cop comes in, doesn't know it's Jim Morrison. He's got his new tool, mace. So he told him to get out of the dressing room, and Jim was not going to suffer any fools. You know, I'm sure gave him a good four-letter. And, you know, the cop just pulled out his mace, squirted him in the face. And he just, you know, that's when I enter Richard Loren and Ray. And, you know, he's screaming. He's got his eyes are, you know, full of mace. And he said, I'm demanding an apology and so on. And, you know, anyway, that's kind of the opener.
And then, of course, he took it on stage.
Right.
Which is where it got really out of hand.
Yeah, with the police were out of hand because they didn't want to hear the truth expounded, you know.
Right. Didn't want to share that so much. So, now the majority of High Notes focuses on your time and experiences with Jerry Garcia, who you were personal manager for, and then you became eventually the manager and the road manager for the Dead itself. But Jerry, I mean, Jerry's been gone, I'm thinking about 2 decades now, about.
Well, it's the 20th anniversary is in August of his death.
Okay. So is that the timing for the book? Does that explain the timing of the book?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I had no intentions of really writing the book at all until I met the student from Bates College in Maine, and he actually interviewed me for like 2 or 3 hours. I was retired. I didn't have really too much happening at the time, but I was thinking of putting together the 30th anniversary DVD CD of the Grateful Dead's performance at the Pyramid, which I had the vision for, and with the help of others in the Grateful Dead community, put together. I when he met me and he asked me a lot of questions about my career, and I told him about my life in the music, and he's in the music business. He says, you know, you got to write a book. You got to write a book. I said, well, look, Alex, I said, I can't really do it now. I said, maybe later. I put it in the back burner. So I eventually hired the kid, Alex. He was like a sophomore in college, and a music major, a great musician, and a sitar and player, and just a great guy. And he offered to help me with putting this Rock in Your Cradle, which ultimately became that DVD CD for 4 years. And he became my editor for a piece I directed there. But when that was over in 2008, I was on a bike ride one day, and I started to think of, you know, maybe I would, you know, I took a couple of hits and went for my bike ride, and I had some, you know, some Illumination. And I was thinking, well, you know, it could be interesting. I said, you know, the bookends of Liberace and one end and the Grateful Dead at the other. I said, huh, maybe there's something there with Jim Morrison and Airplane in the middle. And so I just sat down and I started to write chronologically all events. And I'm not a professional writer. I was an English major and did some writing in college, but you know, I'm not a trained writer by any means. But I just thought, well, let me just put everything down. So I wrote probably 150 more pages than appear in the book now. And that's how I got it. And it took me like 4 years to put it down. And that's how I began to do it.
Where, just out of curiosity, where did Stephen Abney come in? What was his role?
Well, Stephen Abney was actually a very good friend of mine who was an unpublished writer who I met when I quit the Grateful Dead. I started my own video rental company that I provided video rentals and tape recorders to hotels in 1983, just when VHS was coming out. And I came up with the idea of starting this company called Room Service Theater that would provide entertainment for guests at a hotel in the evenings. So it became very, very successful. But in the beginning, I needed a partner who could, you know, would write the reviews of the movies and put a book together. And I put an ad in the paper, and I met him in a cafe, and we became fast friends. And then when I left the Bay Area in 1995, and I sold my business then, and I moved to Rome and so on, and I moved to Maine. And then when I wrote this book, and I'd been kind of in touch with him, as you know, every once in a while we'd talk and so on. And then when I finished the book, I decided, well, you know, I really need an editor. I need an editor. I need somebody to help me with this thing. So I sent over the first few chapters over to Steve, and he started to read them, and he agreed to help me shape the book. And he taught me a lot of things about narrative flow and not to be extraneous, and because I just wrote way too much and just too much stuff. And you know, people, he helped me create what I hope is a page turner for a memoir. I think I wanted, my idea was to get people to want to know what happened next. And I decided to shape the book as not a pay-in to Jerry Garcia or to rock musicians as a whole, but to just to tell the story of my coming of age, cultural coming of age, you know, gaining my rites of passage with a lot of kids my own age that were 21, 22, but they happened to be rock stars. And, you know, I wasn't a musician, and I hadn't really gotten high yet. And then I started to get high with them. And especially, I mean, and it's one of the reasons I've had some illuminations about life. I no longer was driven by a desire to be successful in the old world definition, you know. And I realized that I felt the real communion with these artists that I was representing, and I felt that they were being betrayed by the managers who represented them. I thought they were treated like commodities. I mean, I go on the road with the Doors and go through, you know, the test of fire with Jim Morrison. I'd come back, and the first thing my boss wanted to know was, how much did we make? You know, and it just, after a while, it just bothered me because, you know, I had a more of a communion with the guys I was working for as musicians, my clients, than I did for the people that I was supposed to be, you know, working with. And I wasn't treated well by the company, the APA that I was working for. And I thought I was treated unfairly. But I guess if my goal had been really to be, you know, the guy with the corner office and the vice presidency, I would probably put up with a lot more. But I wasn't ready. I didn't want to go there, you know. And I dropped some acid in Germany in 1969, and I just had an awareness that, you know, I got to get out of here because I was one of these kind of guys that really always followed my intuition, and if it wasn't going to be fun, I really didn't want part of it. So I was it basically for me. I didn't know what I was going to do when I quit.
So you really didn't think that $500 bonus was enough, huh?
Well, not when I was bringing in tens of thousands of dollars to the agency.
I was,
you know,
like,
I was being paid $125, you know, I mean, I was being literally taken advantage of. I mean, I'd be up till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd have to report for work at 10. And then, you know, I'd have to be the businessman, you know, and deal with shady promoters, you know. So
when I read that, I thought, man, what a cheap-ass, dumb-ass guy that had you, I mean, just ridiculous.
But, you know, that's not unique. That's
no,
not.
I know, yeah. You were producing. That's the thing. You were clearly producing, so right. there was no excuse for it, really.
But greed, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, where is that guy today? That's what I want to know.
Dead.
We got what he deserved.
We're all going there. He's just a little older than
That's
we
not
were.
True.
He was very successful, though. He was Harry Belafonte's best friend. You know, and Hal Belafonte was a client of the agency, and he was Dick Martin and Dan Rowan were his friends. You know, because they were the same age.
Yeah.
You know, if you weren't born late enough, you didn't get it. I mean, I know people that are just 3 or 4 years older than I was, and, you know, are totally straight, you know, and they can't believe what went down because they just missed it.
There's that whole generation of people in the music business who, you know, they had their lunch taken from them because they just refused to bend. They didn't understand what was happening right in front of their eyes. And they just figured it'll go away. Isn't real.
It's clueless.
It's ridiculous. All right, so let's come to the main event. We've beat around the bush a little bit, kind of deliberately. I want people to hear these other stories. How did you first connect with Jerry Garcia? How does that happen?
Well, I quit the business, the agency business, in 1969 and moved to Europe. And I just took a year off in Europe, and there's a chapter in my book that explains what I did there. But when I came back, from Europe, mostly I spent in Italy, and I connected with my heritage, family's Italian, and so I enjoyed it when I was there, and I had a good time, but I was missing my connection with the counterculture that I'd become part of. And while I was away, all this music was coming out, and I would go to the local record store and listen to music. So I'd say, I got to come back. But I didn't know what I wanted to do because I didn't want to go back into the business of being an agent for these artists and having to deal with the snakes that were telling me what to do. So I was really at a loss. I came back. I was walking the streets of Greenwich Village, and sure enough, I ran into David Grisman. Now, David Grisman was a musician that I had met. He was in a group called Earth Opera that I put on the show with the Doors. They were on Elektra Records, and Jack Holzman, who actually gifted me with the Doors right after the Jefferson Airplane, asked me if I would represent the Earth Opera. And Peter Rowan was also a member of Earth Opera, and he and David, with Jerry, later formed Olden in the Way. But anyway, so I was pretty friendly with David, and I really got along with him really well. And I moved to Europe, and the Earth Opera disbanded. So he was in the village, walking on the streets. He'd got an apartment. His mom had just died. He inherited a little bit of money. And he had listened to the music of Peter Rowan's two younger brothers, Chris and Lauren, who were fantastic singer-songwriters. And David wanted to do something with them. And when he and I met, we started to talk about, you know, and he said, well, why don't we form a company? You could try to get them a record deal, and I'll take care of the music end of it. And I listened to their songs, and they were just unbelievably beautiful, very, very Beatlesque. And so we formed a business, a partnership. And about a month or so after we'd gotten together, I guess, something like that. David said, hey, you know, Jerry Garcia and Grateful Dead are coming into town. I haven't seen Jerry since 1964 when we played in the parking lot at a bluegrass festival, you know, like the Deadheads do with the Grateful Dead. So this is like 1970, so it's been 6 years. So he said, they're playing. He said, let me give him a call. Maybe we can go catch a show. He said, Working Man's Dead's just come out, and we were listening to it. We really liked the album. I said, yeah, far out, call him up. So he called him up, and he got able to actually get Jerry on the whole phone at the Chelsea Hotel. And sure enough, Jerry put some tickets backstage, and they were playing with the New Riders. They did an acoustic electric set. Jerry played with the New Riders and then with acoustic, and then he played with it. They finished at 4 o'clock in the morning. David and I go backstage and start talking to Jerry. You know, he pulls out his silver cigarette case, takes out a roll of joints, starts to smoke a joint, and we hang out for like 2 hours, just raving about everything. I mean, we talked about the Dead's bust in New Orleans. We talked about the ride across Canada, the Festival Express, and just everything from politics to aliens to suppressed ancient knowledge. And, you know, he was into everything, Jerry. You know, he's interested and interesting. And the time just went by and went by. Anyway, so he said, "What are you doing, Dave? What are you guys up to?" And Dave said, "Well, Richie here used to work for Liberace, and we got a good chuckle out of that," and so on. But he was definitely open and just a wonderful guy. So David said, "Well, we're working on these two kids, the Rowan brothers, Peter Rowan's two younger kids, and we're trying to catch a break here in New York, but it's really hard to get a record deal." And Jerry said, "Hey, man, you guys ought to come to San Francisco. I mean, I'll put in a good word for you. There's loads of clubs over there. You know, we can make it happen. Come on out. You guys should think about that." So, you know, it didn't take a nanosecond before David and I immediately embraced that California state of mind and, you know, folded the tent in New York. And I went out a scouting mission to California, and that was 1970. And very quickly, unfortunately, despite the fact that we got the biggest record contract in the history of Columbia Records for the Rowan Brothers, and there was a bidding war between David Geffen and Clive Davis, and Clive Davis won, and the Rowan Brothers just didn't make it. I mean, Jerry Garcia told Rolling Stone about how great they were. They write songs like the Beatles. Clive Davis took out a big billboard on Sunset Strip saying, you know, "These guys are like the Beatles," or whatever the exact quote, because I don't recall. And it was, you know, the press didn't want to be told what's good and what's not good and what they should buy or not buy. And so they did. That record was, I think, a pretty good record, and had some great songs on it, and it just didn't make it. And then their subsequent two records didn't make it anyway. But after the first record, you know, we'd gone through our advance money, and, you know, David went his way, and the Rowan Brothers went their way on their career, and I was kind of left in the lurch. I really didn't know what I was going to do with my life, you know. And during those years that we were developing the Rowan Brothers' careers, I had befriended Jerry. You know, we got kind of close. We lived in the same town, and I'd go up and visit him at his home with Mountain Girl and just hang out and listen to music and stuff. And one that I went up there the day after, shortly after the Rowan Brother band disbanded and David and I broke up our partnership, that I went up and he said, "Gee, Rich, you look pretty disconsolate." I said, "Well, you know, kind of at another little break in my career here. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do." I said, "You know, our involvement with the Rowan and mine with David is kind of broken up now because they didn't really make it, as you probably know." And he said, "Hey, I need some help. Come work for me, you know." He said, I have a lot of stuff I'm doing outside of the Grateful Dead, and I need somebody to kind of keep things together. I'm working with Merle Saunders. I've got a lot of recordings I'm doing, and I just can't keep up with everything. And I've got a glove compartment full of checks that I haven't cashed yet." He says, "I just can't do it, you know, and I want to concentrate just on my music." So, you know, I jumped on that, of course, in a New York second. And next thing you know, we were going over Jerry's things he had on his burners, and I worked for 2 years as solely his manager, in all things not Grateful Dead. Although I did have to commune with manager of the Grateful Dead, so we don't trip up, you know, with one another in terms of scheduling, and so on.
So 2 years up close and personal with Jerry Garcia, you know that there are deadheads watching this who just can't imagine what that must have been like. What was that like?
Well, it was like just hanging out with a dear friend. I mean, Jerry was a real human being. You know, he was a mentor to me in how to behave as a human being. You know, he's the kind of guy that treated everybody with deep respect. He wasn't on an ego trip. He was kind. He was humble. And he, in the course of the years that I spent with him, we traveled a lot and we met a lot of people. And everybody he met and he encountered, he made them feel as if they were his friend. And, you know, they walked away with, "Wow, you know, Jerry Garcia, man, you know? And he cared about everybody, whether it was a deadhead or speaking to a record company executive, he gave everybody their due and respected them all. He was extremely intelligent. He was extremely well-read. And he was a kind of a rock and roll Buddha, I hate to say, you know? I mean, it's like kind of a cliche maybe, but, you know, he never, you know, I'll tell you one little story. I asked Jerry once, I said, you know, what, well, you never speak on stage. And a lot of artists don't speak on stage. Well, you know, he said, once when I was high on acid, he said, you know, I heard somebody on stage, you know, and I flashed on Hitler. He said, and I realized I never wanted to make any statements from stage because I realized what the power of it was. And I never want to tell anybody what to do. Wow. Now, whether it be he's the leaderless leader of the Grateful Dead, he never told the band members what to do. Even he would always bring this idea up to them to discuss. And it was always a great idea because Jerry had the good ideas. So the other members would basically put in, you know, their input, but it was Jerry's ideas, but it was never the dictatorial expression of you know, what his ideas were. But anyway, interestingly enough, the era in which the Grateful Dead performed and lived was during the time of a counterculture where groups were political. You know, they were anti-war, they were this, they were that. The Grateful Dead never spoke for any causes. You know, they may have done a show here or there for something, but basically it was all about music. And anybody that knows Jerry, even from having read them, Deadheads or not, know that Jerry never sought the limelight. You know, he was in it for the music. He just wanted to grow as a musician, and that's all he really cared about. I wish he'd have taken a little more care of his body, which is, you know, I mean, he had his demons like anybody, you know, and he had an addictive personality. He would smoke a lot of cigarettes, eat a lot of junk food, not take care of his body. And he got into a diabetic coma as a result of that. And Jerry was the kind of guy that he was, you know, music-centric. And, I mean, even his children will tell you he was not a nuclear head of a family. You know, he didn't give his kids the time he wanted. He probably should have given him early in their lives. I'm talking about his older children. Later on, he got a little closer. But so he, you know, I mean, let's see, what else can I say? There was nobody more interesting to talk to about anything. And it was interesting being in his presence because we, soon after I became his personal manager, we rented this whole house where it was kind of separate. It wasn't part of the Grateful Dead. And we conducted business there, but it would be more like a clubhouse where Jerry and, you know, and John Kahn and myself and Keith and a lot of other friends of Jerry's, whether they be the Diggers or the whoever he, you know, or what's his name? I can't think of it. Anyway, anybody that was Jerry's friend in the Bay Area would kind of show up at the office. And we'd have like confabs. The people would hang out for 2 or 3 hours. And then around noontime, you know, Jerry would go his way and I'd just work on the business. But during those early morning hours, we watched movies. I got a projector and a TV and a screen. And we'd rent movies from Hollywood. They'd be shipped up. We'd spool them through it. Jerry was a big, big fan of film. And as a matter of fact, I think he'd hoped to maybe at some point in his career become involved in film as a director, and you know, which is a whole other issue that, you know, we could go into or not.
Well, now there's Jerry Garcia, who was a real live flesh and blood man, and there's Jerry Garcia, who is this icon and continues to be an icon. He's a commercial icon. He's, you know, what's the biggest misconception you've heard from someone over the years about who your friend Jerry was and, you know, what he represented?
Well, to tell you the truth, Bob, I think pretty much everybody adores him. I mean, I haven't really heard people say very bad things about him. You know, the thing about Jerry and a lot of other performers is charisma. You know, there's books written about charisma. And charisma is just something that you exude. It's like a force field. You know, it's like when Jerry goes on stage, he's exuding a presence that it's indefinable. Like other artists, whether it's Mick Jagger or Jim Morrison, and they're giving out a vibe that reaches out, that's invisible, that touches everybody. And the Dead, and he managed to touch people of his kind who lived a life kind of like he was living, in a way. I mean, the Deadheads kind of mirror Jerry and the Dead. I guess Deadheads will understand that. I mean, and you know, a lot of Deadheads get a really bad rap, but, you know, some of the nicest and the best people I met are Deadheads, you know, and I dare say the happiest and the less stressed out, you know.
One of the biggest things that you accomplished during your time with the Dead itself was the concert in Egypt at the Pyramids of Giza. It was 3 days of concerts. I love the story in the book about the truck that got stuck in the sand cutting across. You would think, you know, you read that and you go, it literally was driving across the sand with all this equipment. I mean, no roads? Yeah, I mean, it's just...
Well, there are roads, but the actual stage was, you know, off the road, you know, because it's not, I mean, it wasn't as if that stage was used for like a rock and roll band with a lot of equipment. So, you know, they had some ballets there, they had some theatrical stuff, they did the sound and lights with the lights, you know, but it wasn't a rock and roll venue, you know. Like, I kind of made it a rock and roll venue when I just first saw the stage riding around in a Camel. I looked down and said, wow, a stage here, you know. I said, God, Dead should play here. Wouldn't that be great, you know? I don't know where that came from, but I felt, I felt that it was going to be a possibility because I made a connection with Egyptian people. And they were especially, you know, they smoked a lot of hash. All the men smoked hash. So, you know, that they had a certain lightness about things, that there was a, you know, they had the same loose laid-back style and spirit of the hate, in a way, you know. So there was that connection. There was, and at that time, we were making a connection with Egypt. They had just Anwar Sadat had become president, and he'd thrown out the Russian military and so on. And so they were really enamored with America. And so it was kind of a very propitious time that I went there for my first trip. Actually, Marty Balin is the one really responsible for the Grateful Dead going to Egypt, to truth be known. I was living with him for a month or so before I got involved in working with Jerry, and he had an incredible collection of books, and he was an avid reader and really a Renaissance man, but he had a collection of books on Egypt, and I just gravitated toward them, and I just, you know, I read them voraciously while I spent a month with him, and I decided, this is 1970, the first chance I get, I'm just going to go to Egypt. I want to see that place. So sure enough, when the Dead went on hiatus in 75, the first place I went to was to Egypt, and I went to Egypt actually on the heels of Ken Kesey, who was commissioned by Rolling Stone to write five installments for Rolling Stone on The Search for the Secret Pyramid, which came out and was coming out. Actually, when I went to Egypt, he put out two installments, and I met Ken, and he gave me all these tips about Egypt that I put to good use during my first trip.
It's bizarre that it wasn't filmed in a proper way, that it's been preserved.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. The reason for that is that when we got the contract signed, I was hit upon by several filmmakers that they wanted to film the event, you know. So I talked to Jerry about it alone once. I said, Jerry, you know, we could get this thing filmed, you know, there could be, you know, we could make some money. He said, nah, he said, you know, we just want to have fun. We don't want to be marred by cameras. We don't want the experience to be sacrificed on behalf of cameras in our face. So a week went by, and then I said, you know, Jerry, I said, I know we don't want to film it professionally, but I have a Super 8 camera, and I got a friend that's kind of a cameraman. I'd like to take some stuff for the Super 8. You don't mind if, you know, I go around and try to kind of document it? He said, no, that'd be cool. That way we have... He said, you know, he even said, well, you can go collect all the footage of the other people who take Super 8s and we'll do something. So sure enough, that's exactly what I did. And so, you know, some of that footage came out in Rock in the Cradle. Rhino gave me a 15-minute space to do the bonus on their DVD of The Grateful Dead in Egypt, which is called The Vacation Tapes, and it's some The Grateful Dead in on a little boat ride and going down the Nile and them and the, so looking at the tombs and the pyramids and stuff. It's just a, you know, home movie, basically.
Not entirely what you had in mind.
No, not at all. No. But we'll leave it at that.
Well, let's, we've been at this for a while, so I want to kind of start winding down. I got to ask you about Bill Graham. You don't have, it's pretty clear from the first time he's mentioned that this is not your this was not your favorite guy. And he does not come off very well. But frankly, he doesn't come off well in a lot of people's accounts of him. What was it about this guy that, you know?
Well, he had two sides to him. First of all, he grew up, you know, coming out of the pogroms of Russia, you know. He came, you know, he saw, and he had a lot of ambition. And he was a real, he embraced capitalism, unfettered capitalism. He was a hard worker. He was determined. He got the job done. He was the Sol Yurok of rock and roll. But, you know, you don't get super wealthy like that without being maybe a little bit too good a businessman and taking advantage of a lot of the artists that he worked with. And he was a man of many parts. And, you know, the viewers will have to just read the book because there's too much I say about Bill Graham because, you know, I had different experiences with him. First, he was the manager of the Jefferson Airplane and he had to approve the dates that I offered to the band. Then later when I became the manager of the Grateful Dead, he resented me because, number one, that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to be the manager of the Grateful Dead. The Dead never trusted him to be manager. They trusted him to be his friend and a wonderful promoter, but they realized they needed somebody to look after the till when it came to Bill. So, you know, he and I got on a lot of battles and stuff, but, you know, he gave as much as he took. You know, so I don't have any qualms. I mean, I think, you know, God bless him. He's a large man.
Easier to have this book come out when he was not around to protest?
Again?
Was it easier to have this book come out at a time when he was not around to protest?
I tell you the truth, you know, I don't really care because I don't care what people think about my book because that I took the high road with this book and I was honest, as fair as I could be to everybody, and I avoided being unduly prejudiced. I mean, I didn't go after, you know, turning stuff over that wasn't. I mean, I don't have a need for that. You know, I published the book myself just because I didn't want to have an editor or publisher tell me what to write. I didn't want them to tell me what kind of cover I wanted to have with the book. You know, I don't want to be owned. I wanted to do it my way. It cost me money to do it, but it's doing very well, and I'm really pleased with the results. I'm very pleased with the response I've gotten from writers and critics, and I couldn't be happier, to tell you the truth. So,
are there enough stories out there that you'd ever consider doing a second book, or do you think you got it all off your chest here?
I kind of got it off my chest. You know, I'm 72 years old now, and I basically want to learn to play the piano better than I do. And I want to spend a lot of, you know, just time with my grandsons. And I just want to enjoy things. I don't want to be, because it's difficult to write a book. I recommend it to anybody to revisit their life, to write a book, or if they don't even write a book, just to revisit their life. Because it is so rewarding to look back on your life and see the crossroads that the path not taken and the path taken and the could have been, the would have been, you know. It's just interesting to observe your behavior as an older person, especially looking back on how you behave. What could have been? What if I'd have done this and what of that? And I look back, I really don't have any regrets. You know, I learned a lot. And, you know, when you're young, you have passion, but the passion is for the young. You know, the older you are, hopefully you'll gain some wisdom, you know, and that's my goal, is to try to, you know, do the best I can in the remaining years of my life. And, you know, I mean, you know, an idol of mine, Alex Gray, you know, said, you know, every moment is an opportunity for love and transformation. And I've really embraced that little tenet because I think we can all grow.
All right. Well, folks, listen, you can find Richard Lawrence's account of his years on the road with the Doors, the Jefferson Airplane, the Chamber Brothers, I don't think we mentioned, Jerry Garcia, and, of course, the Grateful Dead in High Notes, A Rock Memoir. It's available in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching this video, if you're watching this as a video, below the video on MrMedia.com, you'll see either over there, or on the, either on the left or on the right, is the cover of the book. You can click on it right now. It'll take you to Amazon. You can order the book instantly. I understand they have drones that they can get it to you in 30 minutes or less. I'm not guaranteeing that. You'll have to check that out with them. But you get a great price on it. Just click and order
it. It's an ebook.
And it's an ebook, so you can have it instantly. You don't even have to wait 30 minutes, for God's sakes. So don't wait. Richard, you've got a website for the book?
Yeah. It's highnotes.org.
.org, okay. And are you a Twitter guy, Facebook, or can we
Facebook, the High Notes Facebook page. There's a lot of information on there. There's a sample chapter. There's bios of the artists I work with. There's my bio. There's just a wealth of information, lots of pictures. And it's I posted a lot of interesting YouTube videos and things. I think your viewers and fans of the Grateful Dead, the Doors, the Airplane, and everyone else will find it enjoyable or something there that they'll want to look at.
Very good. Well, Richard, fascinating conversation. Really interesting book. Very precise stories. There's not a lot of there's not a lot of fat on the bones. It's very, very meaty. Really good stories. So anybody who's a fan of any of these bands or just interested in the record business and the music business, you really need to check this out. And I want to say thank you very much for joining us today on Mr. Media.
Hey, man, been my pleasure, Bob. Thanks so much. Good interview.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye bye.
Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com. The George and Tony Entertainment Show. From the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Chirac guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, the reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lowell Melser crying about the O's again.
Close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
What you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
Oh, yeah. Hey, these are two guys that we once actually
to call them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot.
Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.